What is going on? Happy 2019, everyone. It is the MMA podcast, January 2nd. A fine Wednesday coming through, as usual, with Sweet Pappy Jones on Twitter. It's P-Money. Pat, happy 2019. How's it going? Are you feeling any different here in the new year?
Oh, Jake, happy 2019. Happy New Year to you and all the listeners over there. You know, I dare say I am feeling different. You know, I woke up New Year's Day just ready and reinvigorated, re-inspired, as you should be every New Year's Day, just ready to go get it. I'm very motivated for 2019, Jake. I think there's some beautiful things ahead for the MMA podcast and for all of the listeners.
I like it, man. And I agree. We had a fun little card, I guess. That's what we'll get to first, this UFC 232 card that went down this past Saturday, December 29th. Kind of wild in the build-up to it. The event originally supposed to take place at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. However, just 6 days before the fight on the 23rd on Sunday, the event was moved from Vegas to Los Angeles due to John Jones' drug testing abnormality, shocker, stemming from earlier in the month. Apparently, they found a trace of Tarenabol in his system. And if that sounds familiar, that's the same substance he tested positive for in 2017 that led to the 15-month suspension that he just was cleared from in order to fight. And for some strange reason, I guess most of the Nevada Athletic Commission was out of town on vacation. So because they didn't have proper time to investigate it, they passed it along to Andy Foster in California, good buds with Dana White, just like Jeff Nowitzki. It all just, you know, it all reeked of shadiness. There's not one thing you can put your finger on and say, aha, look what they did here. But just, you know, it just reeked. You know, they had that bit on SportsCenter with Dana White and Jeff Nowitzki, both with their arms folded, looking like they both just committed a crime. If you really want to listen to somebody who knows a ton about it and go into detail, I put up a link on the MMA podcast Twitter, but you can go and follow the man himself, Larry Pepe, on Twitter. That's LarryPepe. And he knows more about all this than any single person I've ever heard in the sport. And he basically said the UFC's drug testing program essentially ended with them kowtowing to John Jones, making things up because they didn't have a precedent for it, and allowing somebody who failed a drug test to fight. The comparison I think he used is it would be like if a cop found heroin in a baggie after pulling you over, but saying, you know what? This isn't enough heroin to get you high, so you're free to go. The fight was moved to Inglewood, California, although it ended up screwing over a bunch of fans. I think the fighters all had to lose about 10% in income tax going from Nevada to California. Dana just, you know, the excuses were so... Just, I mean, you know, he's saying to fans who spent thousands of dollars to fly out to Vegas for the fights, telling fans that most casinos will be airing the fights and be happy that you can go and watch the fights on a TV from a casino in Las Vegas. Just, I don't know, Pat, you have thoughts on all of this, all of this turmoil going on before the fight card itself, which the fight card itself was amazing. I don't want to take anything away from the great performances, and I for sure want to focus on that and not all of this. But just what I think could be a watershed moment as far as people looking at the UFC as a incredible organization.
Jake, I think this was really handled very poorly. This detracted so much from the fight weekend itself. I was really looking forward to UFC 232, and just a couple days before the fight takes place, they announce that John Jones has a couple picograms of Tyrannobol, which apparently is a unit of measurement that is so infinitesimally small that when all of these developments were being broken, they said, well, do we even really need to test that far? Once you test that far, it's not even relative to your performance. So maybe we just shouldn't even be testing that far. And Frank Mir was coming out saying, hey, I had tests with similar levels. And they said that that was a suspension for me. He got hit with a suspension for very similar picogram levels of substances in there. Just as recently as 2017, if I'm not mistaken, Frank said, maybe even halfway through 2017. So you know, just a year later, they're finding out, oh, yeah, well, this is potentially something that once you've taken it can potentially just show up there at any time. It'll never leave your system. It's called pulsing. This is what they're talking about. And to me, I'm sitting here saying, okay, well, if it is such an infinitesimally small amount to where it's not affecting John Jones' performance, isn't this just an indicator then that he has taken enough steroids over the course of his career to where a substance that isn't naturally occurring in nature or in your human body, you've taken so much of it that now it just shows up randomly in your system? Like, nothing about that really sounds right to me. You could definitely debate how much it's actively helping him, how much did it really help him on the night of the fight with Alexander Gustafsson. But some would say, hey, it's already been done. The change from steroids, you look at John Jones' body compared to just a few years ago, compared to where he is now, he has put on so much muscle. He's got an almost completely different frame. He's way thicker than before. And it appears that a lot of this has been done through steroid use. He's failed multiple times. And the only thing I can glean from this pulsing is that it's now just never going to leave his body because he's abused steroids so much. But instead of them saying that this is, oh, well, it's not actively enhancing his performance, so the fight can go on. We'll just have to switch it to a different venue. And then the atrocious way it was handled, Dana White saying, what about the money I'm going to be losing? I'm losing money. We're all losing money on this. Despicable. I would love to see a class action lawsuit from the fans and fighters against Dana White and the owners of the UFC regarding the way that UFC 232 was handled.
You know, I did a little bit of sleuthing myself, and one thing that Larry said on his podcast about Tyrannobol was that it had a half-life of 16 hours, which the half-life of a chemical means that a lot of chemicals will on their own dissolve and go away. And that means if you have 1 gram in your body, then 16 hours later, you will have half of that. Your body will absorb it. It will go away. Certain things, I think like weed, will stay latent in your system for a long time, up to like a month. Certain things like cocaine, out of your system in a day or two. So the number that Larry gave was 16 hours. I actually took that number. I think it was 20 to 60 picograms, which is 10 to like the negative, I think, 26th power or something. I took that number and I multiplied that by 2, and then I did that to the power of, I forget what I found it to be, but it was how many cycles, how many half-life cycles from the drug test way back that they're claiming this is residual from to now, how much it would have made sense for it to dwindle down and down and down and down. And, you know, for all I knew, it could have made sense that, okay, true, it works out. If he took a 200 milligram ingestion X amount of months ago, fast forward to this, you have X amount of cycles where it will go down by a half. Then by this time, you will be seeing a picogram amount. Is what I'm saying makes sense? So far?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Just want to make sure I'm not out on a limb here and not explaining it correct. So I did the math, and I saw how much he would have needed to take way back when he tested originally. And I believe that amount of Tyrannobol that he would have had to take was something like 100 trillion times the size of Jupiter. So I really don't think he took... It was like 20 kilograms to like 10 to the fucking 40th. It was like a size like as big as like the universe. It was something that would be impossible if you use the math and try and do it. So, you know, what I think this is a symptom of, you know, you've had a lot of not fighters, but different trainers and voices come out about microdosing. That seems to be something that a lot are taking advantage of. But I don't know. You know, you can't really definitively pin anything on John, and maybe that's why the UFC chose to take this direction, because they knew that, you know, there's not anything specifically here that you can pin to him. And you know, a lot of folks think it's junk science, but unfortunately, there's not really many experts. It was hilarious. Dana referred to the experts, and then Ariel asked who that was, and said he didn't know, and to find out for himself, and Ariel did actually find out who he was referring to. But, you know, I think Jeff Nowitzki was on Joe Rogan's podcast saying, like, well, you know, the average guy sitting at home doesn't know that there's a difference between Tyrannobol and oral Tyrannobol. And Joe goes, oh, what is that difference? And Jeff Nowitzki's like, I don't know. It is a clown show.
Insanity.
Yeah. Let's get to the actual fights, what we're here for. A fun card, a nice way to bang out 2018. We'll start, as we always do, with the early prelims. And I got to say, at least for me, the highlight was seeing Uriah Hall, who we have a history going back to Tough 17 with, talking to him way back when he was the star of that show. Has had a very up-and-down career, gets a huge KO, takes the mic, very emotional after the fight, talking about his sister battling depression and all that. Said he won the fight for her. Also, big wins by Montel Jackson, not to be confused with Montel Jordan, winning a first-round Darce choke submission victory over Brian Kelleher, Curtis Millender with a unanimous decision, and Nathaniel Wood with a rear naked choke. Before going into the Fox Sports 1 card, which was led by BJ Penn and Ryan Hall. And eventually it got to the mat like Ryan Hall wanted. He's a leg lock expert. Penn rolls the wrong way. Seemed to be limping around afterwards. I hope his knee is not as torn up as it looked like it could have potentially been there. But a devastating heel hook that sends BJ Penn walking out with now tied for UFC record, sixth straight loss in the octagon. And as a huge fan of his, I hope that that's the last time we see him step in the cage. Peter Yan, who's having a great up-and-coming year. Hint, spoiler alert to Friday's award show. Big TKO, corner stoppage win over Douglas Silva, De Andrade. Just was pouring blood, his corner wisely stopping it, stopping all of the carnage there at bantamweight. Speaking of carnage, the next fight, a women's featherweight, Megan Anderson, just a minute into the fight, hitting Kat Zingano with, it obviously wasn't anything malicious, but hitting her with this toe to the face, it was a foot to the face, it was a good head kick. But I guess her toe and toenail hit Kat Zingano in the eye. And if you actually know, a notable trainer in the sport, Mike Winklejohn, has one working eye and one glass eye. Apparently, I won't get into the gory details like I was talking with Pat before the show, but apparently a very similar situation where he was just training with a guy, and the guy, I guess, hadn't clipped his toenails or had sharp toenails or something, and threw a head kick and got a toenail to the eyeball and lost his eye. So here's hoping that Kat keeps her eye. It looks like she will. Apparently she has some lacerations to the eyelid and a little bit of damage to the eye. She's appealing the loss. I don't know how successful she'll be with that, because I actually don't think there's any language in the official rules about toes in the eye. They do mention outstretched fingers, but a toe to the eye seems to be such a difficult thing to do purposefully that there's no point in writing it into the rules, because anytime it does happen, it's just going to be a sad kind of what if from throwing a head kick. Last fight of the prelims, which will stop before we move to the main card, Walt Harris versus Andrei Arlovsky. Walt Harris winning a split decision victory in front of the, actually I think the Forum was sold out, big crowd there in Vegas for, or in Los Angeles for the end of the year crowd. Pat, what stood out to the prelims there for you?
Well, lots of fun action for sure on the prelims, on the fight pass portion. Montel Jackson, as you mentioned, getting the submission over Brian Kelleher, came in a little heavy on that one. I was very shocked to see Montel Jackson at bantamweight. This guy, and of course, it makes sense after realizing that he had missed weight, because he looked huge for a bantamweight. I could not believe how he got down to 135, and then he didn't, as it turns out. But very good performance against a guy who had beaten some big names, and Brian Kelleher as of late. Curtis Millender getting a solid W over C.R. Bahadurzadeh. Really impressed with Curtis Millender as of late. He's definitely showing some good potential at the 170-pound division. Uriah Hall, as you mentioned, getting a big TKO over Bevan Lewis. Really good feel-good moment there on the prelims. And Nathaniel Wood with the submission. Definitely some very fun action on the fight pass portion of the card. And Ryan Hall over BJ Penn, man, that was a savage heel hook. Ryan said that it sounded like BJ Penn's knee was popping pretty good when he was turning that submission in. I was thinking to myself, of course it does. You're heel hooking a 40-year-old man. Like, how much cartilage do you really have left in your knees? Once, you know, as you start getting up in age, not that 40-year-old is decrepit or anything like that, but that's still 40 years of wear and tear on your knees. How much cartilage do you really got left to be getting heel hooked like that? Come on. But solid victory, just a couple minutes into the first round. Peter Yan versus Douglas Silva de Andrade, two warriors and 135 pounds. Man, this was a battle, but Peter Yan definitely got the best of it for the most of it. A couple of really high-flying strikers here. Super, super solid kickboxing from both these guys, but Peter Yan made some adjustments, was able to get some takedowns, and he was pretty handily in control of this fight. For the most part, for wherever it went, but once he got it down to the ground, that was definitely where he was more comfortable. Rained down some big elbows, just absolutely busted open Douglas Silva de Andrade, and I was very surprised to see the corner stop that one. It's so funny, I so many times call for it and say, you know, why won't anybody think about fighter health or fighter safety? Why was the corner stopping it? And then when the corner stops it, I was like, oh man, how's the fighter feeling this one? Now your corner doesn't believe in you. I said, gosh, this is definitely wanting it both ways. But I was glad to see Douglas getting saved from a little further injury there. It probably was the best move. Peter Yan was putting it on him, something fierce there. Great stoppage there at the end of the second round. Terrible what happened to Kat Zingano. Just a freakish injury there. Love Kat Zingano. There's a woman who's been through a lot in her personal and professional life. Was really hoping to see her rebound in this one, and man, took that toe to the eye. Hopefully most of it was just to the eyelid. I did read something that seemed like, you know, there was some swelling and some pressure there, but hopefully that'll all go down and she'll be able to retain her ocular health. And Andrei Arlovsky versus Walt Harris, Good fight. It's not often that I enjoy watching heavyweight fights go the decision, but this was definitely a good scrap. They're winging it till the end. Both guys showing good chins, taking good shots. But it was really Walt's fight in this one, I would say. It was a close one. It was a split decision, but I had to give that one to Harris. But definitely good first eight fights for 232.
And that swung us into the main card, starting off with Alexander Volkanovski versus Chad Mendes. Man, I still don't get why they put Volkanovski as an underdog in Vegas, which, you know, I know Chad Mendes, he's still a monster, and I guess he has since retired from the sport, which I would have liked to see him at least go out there and end it on a victory. I mean, still in a stacked featherweight division, he could still melt most of the ranked talent at 145. The guy is a stud wrestler and has proved that he has very, very heavy hands to boot. But going up against a guy, Alexander Volkanovski, who I originally just kind of assumed was a Russian dude, just going by his name and his kind of overall look. The guy is actually an Australian of Macedonian and Greek heritage. That's where the name Volkanovski comes from. So kind of been all over the place. Grew up, born and raised in Australia, actually playing rugby, weighed 214 pounds, just was an absolute, I mean, look up old photos of him, an absolute beefcake, cut all the way down to 145, and doesn't look bad at featherweight either, and put his name on the map, did what, you know, I hate when a guy gets a victory, a major career altering win, all the eyes are on him, everyone is seeing what he's going to say when the fight's over, who do you want next, and all the guy says is, well, I'll fight whoever they put in front of me. That drives me nuts. Call your shot. And that is exactly what Alexander Volkanovski said, saying, you know what, Max Holloway might eventually move up to 155, but before he does, he's never fought a short, stocky wrestler like me. He never fought Frankie Edgar. He never fought Chad Mendes. I'm better than both of them. I want a title shot. So calling his shot at 145, which actually, for the first time in a while, you know, you have Brian Ortega, who just went down. Things have kind of cleared up a bit at 145, and I wouldn't mind seeing a title shot thrown Alexander Volkanovski's way. Another guy making waves in a weight class that has been log jammed up, but isn't looking bad himself, Corey Anderson. Winning a unanimous 29-28 decision against Iller Latifi, who time in and time out has shown he is not an easy out at 205 at all. I mean, I hesitate to call him a gatekeeper just because he's had big wins against guys who have been title challengers. But, I don't know, always seems once he gets up in this rarefied top six, top seven range, he never can keep the wins coming. Whenever he gets up in this top five-ish range, always seems to take another loss and stumble back down the rankings. And speaking of stumbling down the rankings, Carlos Condit, long-time elite welterweight, getting his fifth straight loss in a row. Michael Chiesa logging in the second round. Kimura, that kind of seemed, you know, that kind of seemed to be the theme with a lot of fights here, having newer talent versus older talent, and the newer talent winning the fights, kind of a passing of the guard. And that is somewhat what we saw here. Michael Chiesa just, you know, fighting a guy in Condit who never seemed to be able to get it going. And we've seen a lot of guys move up in weight class and look better. And Chiesa looked excellent at 170, has kind of grown into that new weight class. Interested to see who they put him up against next. Pat, thoughts on those three fights before we get to the two title fights on Saturday night?
Oh boy, Jakey. Well, the main card sure started off with a bang. Chad Mendes versus Alexander Volkanovski. Man, that was a great fight. Back and forth. And as you mentioned, Jake, very disappointed to hear that Chad Mendes is hanging it up. I mean, I can only understand that after a couple years layoff and then a couple tough fights coming back, it could be hard. But, man, that was a very close back and forth. Volkanovski is definitely a top-ranked prospect at the 145-pound division. And these guys both gave each other everything they could handle. They both dropped each other. That probably could have gone Mendez's way just as easily as it went Volkanovski's that night. But Volkanovski was just able to weather that storm for a little bit longer. Ended up getting that TKO himself. Awesome fight. Fantastic scrap. Too bad to hear that Mendez is retiring. But Volkanovski, Jake, I'm with you. I'd love to see him get that scrap or get that strap, get that title fight. The logjam has been cleared. All the interim, Connor, Aldo, Max, everything, it's all done. Ortega, Frankie, everything has worked itself out. Let's keep the new blood coming in here. Get another, at least one more 145-pound title defense in there for Holloway. I'm sure he'd like that too. It seems like he's talked about wanting to defend that 145-pound strap a couple more times. Although, I don't know, it seems like I've seemed to have recalled hearing it both ways, that he wants to go up to 155, he wants to make a couple more defenses, but sure wouldn't mind seeing him take on Volkanovski in his next bout. Corey Anderson versus Ilir Latifi. Good fight, solid showing for Corey Anderson, really showing that he can take on some of the toughest in the division. Latifi, I mean, as powerful a wrestler as it comes, as heavy a hands as it comes, and Corey Anderson was able to negate everything that Latifi threw his way. Very solid showing for a unanimous decision victory. And Chiesa over Condit. I was picking Condit in this one, but dang it, I was picking with my heart. Anybody who's been following Carlos Condit for the last few years has seen the blueprint that Condit always struggles with the guys. And they mentioned this on the broadcast, but Condit always struggles with the guys with the wrestling. He has great jiu-jitsu. He has great striking. But the actual wrestling, takedowns, takedown defense, you know, when someone shoots on him, it's almost just given up. There's not a whole lot of sprawling going on. And Condit has been so good from his back that he's been able to get so many fantastic submissions. But nowadays, you know, I just don't know if that is sufficient. People aren't getting caught in too many triangle chokes and arm bars these days. It's the game has evolved a little bit, and just having that wicked guard and that good back game, I don't know if that's really going to be enough. He's got to figure out a way to keep things on his feet and use that dangerous striking that he's got. He's really got great striking, and you know, his ground game is good too. I mean, if he could just, again, shore up that wrestling. But Chiesa, too much for him. Moving up to 170, looking very good. You know, sometimes we see guys move up a weight class, or we see the ladies move up a weight class, and maybe they're carrying a little extra in the spare tire or something like that. You know, not, of course, you know, who am I to talk, but you notice they're maybe not as lean as they are in some other ones. But Chiesa up at 170, still looking very solid, looking very strong, and not just by his performance, but his physical appearance as well. It didn't look like he was carrying extra weight. Looked like he was just in a very good condition physically. And man, he definitely showed it versus Condit. He was able to out-muscle him virtually the entire time, put a very unique, very strong Kimura on him. Beautiful showing from Chiesa. Really looking good at 170.
Yeah, and I'm looking back at those featherweight rankings right now. You have, obviously, the champion in Max Holloway. And going down the list, Brian Ortega just lost. Jose Aldo, and I think he just turned down a main event, I think, in March. Apparently he doesn't want to fight. I still think he needs a win before he jumps back in. And obviously it isn't like he's going to fight Max a third time. Frankie, I think he still really hasn't done much since he lost to Brian. Moicano still lost to Ortega recently. Stevens, I think, is scheduled for a fight. Mendez just retired. Cub just lost. Bektik needs to get one or two more wins other than just Lamas. Josh Emmett just lost. I like Volkanovski. If anyone is going to fight Max next for 45, let's line that up. But we move to the co-main event. And, man, think about the last 4 years for Amanda Nunez. She loses her, I think, second or third fight in the UFC by finish to Kat Zingano. Gets knocked down the ranks. No one really thinks that much of her at 135. And starts a win streak against Shayna Baszler. Slowly but surely gets a submission against Sarah McMahon. Gets a decision against Valentina Shevchenko. Gets put in that main event at UFC 200. Gets a rear naked choke against Misha. Becomes the champ. TKOs Ronda Rousey. Split decision versus Valentina Shevchenko again. TKOs Rocky Pennington. And now with the KO at UFC 232. She ends 2018 as the greatest female fighter, pretty much undisputedly of all time. You can make the argument for a few different guys as far as the best ever in the male ranks. But, man, I think historically with this win against Chris Cyborg, it's hard not to put Amanda Nunez at the top of the list as far as best ever. And, man, there was a wild stat, I think, in her fights versus Rousey, Tate, Cyborg, and maybe Pennington. Just in a bunch of combined fights, she absorbed, I think, like 13 significant strikes. Her ability, she's so fast, her ability to not get hit and just put so much behind her punches. I mean, she was knocking Cyborg to the ground multiple different times. I mean, it was only a 51-second fight, but it felt like a lot. You know, what this actually felt like was so many Cyborg fights we saw in the past, especially in Strikeforce, where they would line her up against just some chump, and some Cyborg would go in there like a pride era of Wanderlei Silva and throw these looping hooks and knock these women across the ring. That's what Amanda Nunez did to Chris. It was an incredible performance, and she put her name as the greatest female fighter of all time in the books with an exclamation point. Great win, great co-main event. Hard not to like her. You know, she's always got a big smile, you know, rarely ever talks any crap about any opponent, seems to be very respectful, always nice during interviews, and yeah, seems like a good person. And now your women's bantamweight and featherweight champ. We'll talk about the whole future of the featherweight division next, but yeah, what did you think about that fight?
Jake, this was an insane fight, an insane moment in mixed martial arts history, in women's mixed martial arts history. Cyborg has been the absolute best female fighter. So, of course, some will say, well, you know, there's a little bit of a debate when Rousey was getting to be the hottest, but Cyborg before then, you know, when Gina Carano was getting to be, she was the first Ronda Rousey, Gina Carano, and she was beating all these girls up. Cyborg comes along and just destroys Carano. Cyborg has always been the number one. And then Ronda Rousey comes along. Unfortunately, her and Cyborg don't fight. But Cyborg has always been destroying the top class. She had never even looked remotely like she'd been in danger in a mixed martial arts fight. She'd been looking like one of the scariest fighters that there's ever been. And Amanda Nunes, you know, she looked more human, as Jake, as you mentioned, in some of her first UFC outings. Well, was a little up and down, you know, had some losses there, but really started to come into her own. Really, once she found the lioness, you know, it seems like she's been pouncing on him, man, and she has been showing some devastating power. You know, the fight that she had, especially, we all remember the Ronda Rousey knockout that Amanda Nunes put together, but her fight before that against Miesha Tate. My goodness, Miesha Tate, one of the strongest grapplers that the UFC women's division have seen. She had no problems with the grappling, and she absolutely busted Miesha Tate's face open with the strikes before she ended up getting the rear naked choke submission. She has just, as of late, been looking almost impervious herself. Cyborg, the only time in the last decade or so she's looked like she's had any kind of weakness was I don't even know if it was an exhibition bout or if it was actually a sanctioned bout she had against another woman's kickboxer, but in mixed martial arts, nobody had looked like she could touch her. And until Saturday night at 2:32, man, Amanda Nunes was just a little sharper. The punches weren't coming as wide. They were coming in a little straighter, still with ferocious intention, still with all the power that a woman's 145er can muster. And man, Amanda Nunes, she generates a heck of a lot of power. It is amazing. And didn't even last a minute. Cyborg, she did have some shots herself. She caught her with some good ones. It was fireworks for the 51 seconds it lasted, but my goodness, Amanda Nunes coming in and getting the TKO, becoming the first first woman to hold two belts in the UFC, first woman to hold two belts simultaneously in the UFC. It was just an amazing moment. And in an underdog situation, taking on a woman in Chris Cyborg, you know, it's got to be like climbing Mount Everest, like David slaying Goliath. It was just a fantastic moment, you know. And I know a lot of people are saying that Amanda Nunes is the greatest of all time. I'm hesitating on that. She's obviously right there. If she beats Valentina Shevchenko in her next fight, the women's 125-pound champion, you know, and then, I mean, although she does already have two victories over her, so you could kind of say that she basically is the lineal three-division champion. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. Or, well, that's actually very pertinent. She very well could be the best of all time. But again, I look at Cyborg's run, you know, the decade plus. I look at Rousey's run, where she had just the years of steamrolling everybody. Those, even though Amanda Nunes, she was the one to stop both of those, or well, she was the one to stop Cyborg's streak and definitely put the coffin in Ronda Rousey, or put the nail in Ronda Rousey's coffin. I don't know. It's like MMA math. I don't know that you can completely usurp those legacies. She is definitely super high, and I don't. Yeah, she's super high up there. I don't know if I'm ready to crown her the GOAT just yet, but one or two fights and she's right there for sure.
I say crown her. She is the new GOAT, the sixth champ in the UFC's 25-year, roughly, history behind Randy Couture, George St. Pierre, BJ Penn, Conor McGregor, Daniel Cormier, the first female champ. One thing, I don't know if everyone caught it, I thought was kind of funny. Chris Cyborg handled the loss pretty well, but the post-fight presser came out with a pillow and was kind of jokingly hiding behind the pillow, which was an homage to Ronda Rousey at the airport on TMZ after she lost. She was hiding behind a pillow to all of these cameras. So still in 2018... you have Chris Cyborg in the post-fight presser trying to troll Ronda. I think Chris knows that there is still money in a fight with Ronda Rousey and Chris Cyborg. And shoot, if Brock Lesnar has taught us nothing, it is that, you know, going over to the WWE isn't necessarily going to prevent you from taking a UFC fight here and there, which we will get to the whole deal with him in DC in a little bit. But before we move on to John Jones and Gus and that whole picture up there, one more thing I want to talk about with this topic, which is the future of women's 145. You know, they really haven't put that much into it. They've seemed to be focusing more on expanding that women's 125-pound division. You have a few fighters. I think Megan Anderson is going to be a big reason why they keep that division, because she, frankly, cannot fight at 35. and has proven that you know, she is a talent to be reckoned with for sure, and I'd love to see her fight Amanda at 145. Just, I don't know if it seems to be a question if the UFC is going to keep that weight class around, if Amanda is going to stay up at 45 or just move back to 135 pounds, a weight she has no problem making. What do you think happens with the future of Amanda and her championships and, like I mentioned, the future of that women's featherweight division at 145?
Well, this is a very interesting position because women's 145 pounds was brought into the UFC solely for Cyborg. That's the only reason they ever had these fights to begin with, was just because that was the only weight Cyborg could make, and they were just in the business of, you know, taking whoever Invicta had at 145 pounds or whoever the Japanese promotions had at 145 pounds. Literally anybody who would sign a contract with Chris Cyborg stating that they would fight her at 145 pounds. That was who they were getting to fight her. But, you know, most of these women, Amanda Nunes, 135 pounds. The good majority of these women look like they want to fight at 135 pounds. Just that there aren't, aside from Megan Anderson and Chris Cyborg, Jake, as you had mentioned, who are some of the two bigger names, and some say really the only two names at 145 pounds. Can we name any other women's 145 pounders besides, I mean, actually, I will just say no, because the only reason I can name any other women's 145 pounders was just the amount of research I was doing prior to the show that refreshed my memory a little bit. But offhand, I wouldn't be able to name a single one of them. Now, perhaps if they want to, Kunitz, again, the only reason I remember that name was just because I was looking at a little research today and her name came up, Cyborg versus Kunitskaya, earlier this year.
That fight alone is enough to point at the complete lack of depth at women's 145 in the UFC.
I mean, most of the fights Chris Cyborg has had has just been her mollywhopping these poor hapless victims at 145 pounds. That's really what it's been as of late. But, you know, I could see them keeping it open for a little bit, you know, maybe letting Megan Anderson get a shot at that 145 pound belt before they close up shop on it. I don't know. Maybe they don't close it up, but I would think they would probably try and set up at least one title defense for Amanda Nunes, just to let her get that double champ title defense under her belt.
Yeah, we'll see what goes down with that. I think anything else on that fight before we move on to Jones Gus, which that was the fight. Even though this was a super fight, and maybe down the line we'll have more historical relevance at their weight class. But I think everyone was looking forward to John Jones versus Alexander Gustafsson, one of the most I guess anticipated rematches of all time. Not just because everyone was clamoring after it at UFC 165, but it took 5 years. Two guys at the very top of the game. Jones, a guy who many consider to be the greatest ever, and it truly was the toughest test of his career. Gus pushed him all five rounds. A lot of fans think Gus won that fight, and it was finally his chance to step back in and make good on it. And, man, I didn't pick against Jones here, but Jones just proving why you don't pick against the greatest to ever step into the cage, absolutely dismantling Alexander Gustafsson, getting a third round TKO from the top there on the mount. Just, you know, I saw a lot of folks call this a bad showing by Jones. And, you know, he didn't deal as much damage and wasn't as active as he was in a lot of other fights. But I think that was for good reason. I think Alex was really looking for the counter in a lot of the first and the second round. And Jones just completely stifled him, just completely neutralized Gus's game, easily won the first two rounds, seemed to be cruising to a victory before he finished it in the third round. And it was a dominant, you know, a dominant performance against, like I mentioned, a guy who the first time around really, really pushed him to almost, you know, has he not step out for a legendary fourth and fifth round? He loses that fight, loses the belt. But John Jones, now your light heavyweight champion. A lot of things said between him and Cormier we'll get into, obviously, in a second. But what did you think of the performance itself? I think all of us expected it to be a lot closer than it was. You know, I saw a lot of folks picking the fight either way, but there seemed to be a consensus that this was going to be close, similar to the first fight, and John Jones just went out there and kicked his ass.
Yeah, I had this one. I initially predicted a John Jones decision for this one, and this definitely was not as competitive as the first fight. John Jones really was showing a lot more looks, very unpredictable. He was showing so many different leg kicks, so many different strikes. You know, was it the steroids, or was it just that John Jones was that much more trained up? I mean, I was watching a little bit of that embedded of him with his strength and conditioning coach. Definitely looks like he was getting after it, putting in some of that work in the gym. And it definitely paid off, able to get the third round TKO over Gustafsson with some really good ground and pound. Gus absolutely wanted out of that fight. John Jones was hammering Gustafsson hard. Those were brutal shots. Yeah, that was over very quickly. Amazing display from John Jones. It's just unfortunate all the tests that have marred his career, but dang it, this was just a fantastic display. Truly one of the greatest fighters that we have seen in the UFC. And great cap to UFC 232. I don't know that we will see Gus return to form like that. I mean, he's now 3-3 since that first fight with John Jones. I think, you know, he still had that fire in him, you know, with the split decision against DC, but I don't know if it was that fight or the fight with Rumble Johnson that just kind of, I feel like that fight with Rumble Johnson kind of took a bit of the fire out of Gustafsson. One of those soul-stealing defeats there. Just a huge, big knockout, first round, home country. He hasn't really looked as good since. Hasn't looked as motivated. Hasn't looked like the mauler since then. Just psychologically, I don't think ever rebounded. And certainly didn't look like he was anywhere near the form he was in their first fight. But again, perhaps that's just a testament to how far John Jones has come, but definitely a solid fight, good performance to end 232.
Yeah, and this is a guy who got as close as you can get to the belt without ever being champ. And I mean, when he got to these fights too, these weren't one-sided fights. You know, he gave John Jones the fight of his career, like I mentioned. I believe the fight with him and Cormier in 2015 was the fight of the year. The guy's had an absolutely dynamite career, so I hope to see him keep doing it. I think he's about John Jones' age, isn't too old. And especially, you know, if we do see John Jones move up to heavyweight, then I think the division is either all his or all Anthony Smith's. And I guess that is the discussion next as to what's next for John Jones. I feel like DC, apparently the fight with Brock Lesnar is a question mark. And he has said recently that if that fight doesn't work out, he would be open to fighting Stipe Miocic again, which I think is a nice compromise. I know he's rooting for the Brock fight, not only because that's a much easier fight, but he would make a lot more money getting a pay-per-view cut from a pay-per-view against a big draw like Lesnar. I don't know. I've been saying for a while that he would take one kind of warm-up fight and then fight Brock and then fight John at heavyweight and then retire. It's hilarious how much John is trying to posture to get the fight at 205 because he knows DC is a better fighter at heavyweight. We've seen it. He has just a ton of power in his hands when he fights up. Almost seems to be faster, even though he weighs a bit more. You know, he's not taking that massive cut a day before the fight, where obviously 205 is a much easier fight for John Jones, a much easier weight cut. I think DC obviously has the advantage if they were to run that third fight at heavyweight. And John is saying things like, he wasn't ever the champ, and I've been the only 205-pound champion since 2011. It's like, dude, you can say that all you want, but Cormier still had your belt because you were ineligible to fight because you were off doing shit like hit and runs and testing positive for T-ball. So Jones can say what he wants. I think DC does, even though he's 0-1 with one no contest, which Jones said he's going to try and get that overturned, which is hilarious. I think DC will essentially have the chips in hand here and have the power to make it at heavyweight. Because I do think that, you know, fighting up is an aspiration for Jones as well. And if you can put John could be the champ with a win over DC, I think that might be enough to make the fight happen. That's the fight I want to see most in 2019, for mainly selfish reasons, over, of course, the obvious ones, like Tony versus Habib, and Robert Whittaker versus Israel Adesanya. I'm going off on a random tangent here, but yeah, John Jones, what I'd like to see happen is him stay at light heavyweight and take on Anthony Smith next. Smith has had a hell of a year. Let's see him run that fight, Lionheart versus John Jones. I think John Jones probably will win that fight and be the favorite, but Smith offers him a lot of different challenges, and he was on the desk for the final Fox Sports 1 pre- and post-fight show and actually had a pretty good showing there with Kenny Florian and Michael Bisping and the whole crew. Before we move on past UFC 232, what do you think is next for John Jones and, of course, by just being forever linked to him, Daniel Cormier, and what happens in the coming weeks with all of that?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question here. You know, Daniel Cormier, his 40th birthday is creeping ahead of us. I want to say March is Daniel Cormier's 40th birthday, somewhere in that month. And he had talked about how he wanted to retire basically by his 40th birthday. So how many fights does he have left? Is he going to retire by that date? Is he going to ride out the calendar year of 2019? I'd be willing to bet he sticks around for 2019. Probably one more fight in each division. Well, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know. Maybe probably be two fights at heavyweight. I would say the John Jones and the Brock Lesnar fights. If he fights twice, I would say it's going to be both those fights. And I think that... I mean, of course, I would pick Cormier over Lesnar for sure. But I might even pick Cormier in the heavyweight battle versus John Jones. I'm not 100% sure. That would be very interesting, very intriguing. That would pique my interest for a third bout between the two. Them at heavyweight for whatever reason. I don't know why it makes me think that's a horse of a different color. But as far as John Jones himself, I would probably like to see him fight Corey Anderson. I know that Anthony Smith has been jockeying for that position, but to me, Corey Anderson, he's got better wins and against some more legit 205-pounders. I think that'd be a bit of a more competitive matchup for John Jones. Well, I don't know that one would be more competitive than the other per se, but for me anyways, I like the value for Corey Anderson's wins just a little bit better than Anthony Smith's W's, but I think aside from Daniel Cormier trilogy fight, I think I see Jones taking on what I know he's not beasting 25-8 anymore. Overtime. Overtime, Anderson. That's right. Jones versus overtime. Book it, Jakey.
I'll fucking book it. We'll see who he fights next. Yeah, I wouldn't mind, you know, as much as we might limit John Jones, it's always fun to see him step into the ring. And, man, he seems to bring the controversy no matter what card he is on. I guess moving on from UFC 232, a couple bits of fight news before we close it out. Francis Ngannou against Cain Velasquez, confirmed for UFC Phoenix, February 17th. Man, you know, Francis and Dana kind of had that back and forth, where Francis kind of hung a lot of his struggles on the UFC. Dana said he had a huge ego and all that. Obviously, some heads bumping. The first thing I thought of when I saw this matchup was, damn, Francis Ngannou shouldn't have pissed off Dana White. Because the last person you want to be fighting, if you're heavyweight, next to the champion in DC, is Cain fucking Velasquez, who I think before he hangs it up will become the champion again. I'd love to see him smash John Jones, but that's neither here nor there. Velasquez is going to murder this guy. Pat?
Dang. I mean, very likely, Cain Velasquez, there's not many people that have given him a very tough time. Fabricio Verdum, really. Well, him and Junior Dos Santos in their first matchup. But Cain Velasquez, he's just almost an indestructible competitor, a true freak at heavyweight. Hopefully he comes back and can get some momentum going his way and can start getting back to some sort of semblance of activity here. I don't even remember the last time Cain Velasquez fought, but I'm very excited to see him get back in the ring versus Ngannou. This is a tough test. I mean, Ngannou, he looked good in his last outing. Looks like he's finally got some momentum going in the right direction himself. Looks like he's getting ready to get back to his winning ways. And Cain Velasquez, man, he's been out for a long time. Of course, you know, some people believe in ring rust, some people don't, but it can be a factor. It just depends on the individual. It depends on the fighter. Will there be some ring rust for Cain Velasquez? Somehow I don't think so. The man is just such a beast, such a competitor. I think he'll come in. If he is healthy, I think he'll come in just as prime as if this was Velasquez from 8 years ago. But hopefully that is the case. Hopefully he's fully healthy. If he is, I as well expect him to smash Francis Ngannou for sure.
And a couple of just clippings here before we get to the last topic. The UFC, unfortunately, deciding to cut Jimmy Smith from their ESPN programming. They're making the switch from Fox. Yeah, from Fox to the UFC. I agree. Bad move. You know, I do have to tip my cap to them. They seem to be doing a good job with the whole Ariel thing. Ariel and Chael enjoyed the New Year's Eve programming they put together. Actually, they have a pretty good selection of UFC stuff on ESPN Plus now. They started off the new year playing, I think, Khabib versus Conor on ESPN2, and then played some what looked like those kind of those clip shows where they show, you know, good finishes and fights and all that. Seemed pretty well put together. Pumped about that. But yeah, Jimmy Smith was doing a great job at what he did. And, you know, you have such a variety of fights going from the pay-per-views to the ESPN Plus cards that you think you could find somewhere to make room for a Jimmy Smith. And I'm sure, you know, the sport is growing. So I'm sure he'll find a place somewhere within the sport. But yeah, it's a shame. The UFC decides not to keep him around. Also, Ali Abdelaziz, Khabib Nurmagomedov's totally 100% not shady manager, saying that Tony Ferguson is 100% not the next fight for Khabib Nurmagomedov. I am 100% not super fed up with all of this shit about Khabib Nurmagomedov going off to fight Floyd, going off to fight God knows who. He needs to come back, and he needs to fight Tony Ferguson, because that is the fight. You know, I actually put out a tweet earlier today, and I said, what fight do you want to see most in 2019? Overwhelmingly, it was Khabib Nurmagomedov against Tony Ferguson. That's the fight we all need to see, we all want to see. And Ali Abdelaziz marching out there saying, Tony Ferguson 100% is not our next fight. And it's like, dude, Khabib, you 100% do not have any title defenses and 100% should not feel entitled to go off and tell the UFC to go fuck themselves just because you beat their golden goose that everyone knew you were going to beat for the last few years. Step in there, you know, a guy like Tony offers you a lot more challenges. 100% don't be a pussy, because that is the fight that we all want to see. Moving on, our last topic, Dana White saying Kamaru Usman will be fighting for the welterweight title at UFC 235 in March. The reason that's interesting is he did not specify who Usman would be fighting. The reason that's interesting is Tyron Woodley is currently your welterweight champion, and as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know, Colby Covington is currently your UFC welterweight interim champion. So Dana White, I don't know if it made much sense with him saying that in March, Kamaru Usman will be fighting for, it's like, well, will it be against either the current champ or the current interim champ? And I guess that means, for some reason, Tyron and Colby won't be fighting each other, not giving an explanation for that. We all know Dana White has butted heads with Tyron a lot for not taking fights. Tyron, you know, as much as I want to see Woodley accept the fights that are offered to him, one pet peeve of mine is seeing a guy who's a non-fighter criticize the injury status of a fighter. It's like, Dana, you're not going in there and fighting. You're making a ton of money off these guys going in there and fighting. If this guy says he's hurt, then he's fucking hurt. You know, these guys aren't Superman. They're human. You have Dana saying, oh, that's why I like Conor. Because he'll go in there and say, ooh, I injured me tum. And he'll still fight. It's like, dude, Dana, what the fuck are you even talking about? Like, he's a fucking disgusting pig human. But going back to Tyron in the welterweight title picture, I don't know if it'll be Tyron, if it'll be Colby. Colby seems to also have drawn the ire of the UFC. Seemed to kind of get the raw end of the deal with Till leapfrogging him to get a title shot. And I hope we get a little bit of clarification, seeing as we're not too far away from March and UFC 235. Yeah, we'll see if Dana or the UFC come out with any news about the welterweight title picture. But apparently, and I wouldn't be shocked if they take it off the table, because it was all just a lie and a ploy in the first place, because the UFC does that all the time too. And Usman will not be a part of plans for fighting for the title at UFC 235. So, but it has been put out there, and Dana White did confirm it after Usman tweeted out a page of their contract. So, Pat, what do you make of this whole shit show ordeal?
Well, I definitely feel inclined to call shenanigans on this one, Jake. Last I recall, I could have sworn I had heard that Colby Covington was facing Tyron Woodley for the next UFC welterweight championship bout. And as you mentioned, Colby Covington being the interim welterweight champion, Tyron Woodley being the undisputed champion, makes 100% logical sense. Tyron Woodley won the belt in 2016. He is 3-0-1 since then and is basically keeping on what is a fairly respectable clip for a champion. I mean, he's basically fighting twice a year since he became the champ, in spite of what does seem like there's been some long injury layoffs there. There was a good gap July 29th, 2017 to September 8th, 2018. Almost a year there where he didn't fight, but prior to that, two fights in 2016, won the belt Then had the draw with Stephen Thompson, 2017, beat Stephen Thompson, beat Damian Maia, then 2018, beat Darren Till. So he's been pretty active as far as any champ could go. Does seem like he's protesting an awful lot as far as the matchmakers and what they're, you know, who they're wanting him to fight, all that stuff. But I mean, he's still getting in there. He's still getting it done. You gotta prop up Tyron Woodley for that. He's still beating whoever the UFC puts in front of him. Don't know why they would put Usman versus Covington if they wanted to do that. I don't know why Usman wasn't in the interim title fight instead. Really, Usman and Covington, I feel like they're almost the same exact opponent for Tyron. Both very similar, very heavy grappling. Going to be very strong test for no matter who Tyron faces, or assuming that Tyron is even going to be the one fighting Usman for the 170-pound belt in March. But, Jake, as you alluded to, this very well could just be a ploy by the UFC to get X party to sign the contract that's sitting on their desk. You know, let's say perhaps Tyron and Colby already have some contracts sitting at their house that maybe just haven't been signed, and maybe there's been a couple figures that they've been arguing over. You know, maybe the management's been trying to grease the UFC, try and get a couple extra bucks. What do? You send a contract to Usman. You say, hey, guess what? You want to fight? How's this sound for your salary? Okay, yeah, we'll get you slotted in for March. And then next thing you know, Colby, Tyron, they see this on Twitter. They see that, oh, Usman's being getting handed these contracts. Well, you guys want your fight? You want to be fighting for the belt? Well, you better sign. There's not a whole lot of room for negotiations left. This could be exactly one of those opportunities. I wouldn't doubt that's what it is. I expect that we see Tyron Woodley versus Colby Covington to unify the interim and undisputed titles come March.
You heard it here first. Yeah, you know, you knew that relationship was going to be doomed from the start. You have a guy in Woodley who, man, if you go watch his appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience, talk about a guy who just can, like, he, you know, don't get me wrong. He seems like a very intelligent person. He's well-spoken. He's been on a bunch of TV shows. He's on TMZ. I know he's been in some movies. Has done very well for himself, is a great champion, but seems to just lack this self-awareness. He's saying to Joe, like, you know, Joe's saying, like, yeah, you know, you're kind of always playing the victim here. And he's like, oh man, I don't know why everyone says that about me. Literally playing the victim to being asked about playing the victim. Just, hilarious. And you have that kind of personality who's always kind of looking to be the victim against Dana White, who is one of the world's biggest assholes. You know there's going to be a little bit of friction there. as far as everything else, happy 2019, people. We're glad you tuned in. If you tune in a couple days, we're going to do our end-of-the-year awards, our male fighter, female fighter, fight of the year, what else? Fight of the year, KO, submission of the year. It's gonna be fun. We're gonna have our tuxedos on. It'll be a black tie affair. So if you do tune in and you download it, you must be wearing a tuxedo. We're going on the honor code. Yeah, we will be back Friday for the, what is this? This will be the 3, 4, 5, 6. This is the 6th annual. Wow, the 6th annual TMP Awards. Proud to be hosting it. Pat, anything else before we let my people go?
Jake, you know what it is. Today, yeah. Last year, this year, every year, nothing but love for the people. Always a pleasure doing it. Can't wait to serve up the TMP Awards for the folks, just a couple days here, and let them know what we thought was the best for 2018.
Been doing it since 2012, and we will continue marching into the future. It's 2019. Any goals you set, anything you do, you know you have our 100% support. You can knock the shit out of all your goals, all your resolutions. You just have to want to do it, and however you trick yourself into doing that, you know yourself better than I I do. But let's have a great 2019. Let's get shit done. Let's look back a year from now, been like, damn, you know, I've had a lot of good years. I've had a lot of bad years. But I rocked the fuck out of 2019. Let's do it, people. We'll see you back on Friday for the awards. Like I said, black tie affair. Show up here in a tux, or we're going to turn you away at the door. We love the shit out of you. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you Friday. Till then, we gone.